From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 13, 2013. A six-person jury in Seminole County, Florida, acquitted George Zimmerman on second-degree murder charges surrounding the death of teenager Trayvon Martin. Authorities urged calm, and we're in the age of social media now. Some of the outrage at the verdict was poured into a hashtag, Black Lives Matter. The Black Lives Matter meme and hashtag became a full-blown movement last year, following the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York, Tamir Rice in Cleveland. There are now 23 Black Lives Matter chapters around the United States and Canada. Nearly 700 demonstrations have carried the Black Lives Matter theme worldwide. Much of their focus is on the alleged injustice suffered by the black community, often at the hands of police officers. But as is often the case when we talk about race, there's been a bit of a backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement. On Twitter, you'll find a trending topic called All Lives Matter. Conservatives in particular have lashed out at the Black Lives Matter movement, saying it unfairly casts blame on police for all incidents involving a black male and a white officer. The subject is not going away. We'll start our discussion there this hour. We're going to cover a lot of ground as we talk about race, equality, building a stronger community, building a stronger Rochester. The Urban League of Rochester marks 50 years this year, and my guests are the two longest-serving CEOs that I just found out have now served, I think, for exactly the same amount of time. That'll be changing soon. Bill Johnson was the CEO of the Urban League for 21 years, 1 month. Is that right, Bill?
That's right.
21 years, 1 month before becoming the mayor of Rochester. Nice to see you again. Thanks for being here,
Thank
Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
Also here is Bill Clark, the current CEO, who is about to surpass in just days Bill Johnson's tenure. 21 years, 1 month. Bill, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for the invite.
Well, I want to start with that question on this back and forth. And unfortunately, sometimes we see, gentlemen, about Black Lives Matter, and then it's All Lives Matter. And, you know, sometimes I think we miss the forest for the trees there. But let me start with Bill Johnson here. You know, you served 21 years, 1 month as the Urban League CEO, then the mayor of Rochester. You've been in this community for a long time. Does it sadden you that we're still dealing with this in this way sometimes?
It really does, Evan, particularly on this issue of deadly use of force by police. Only a couple of years after I came to Rochester, we had a very significant event that occurred here. A young 19-year-old African-American housewife, Denise Hawkins, was shot dead by a police officer who was responding to a call of domestic violence. And so because of the proximity of events, she opened the door, she had a knife in her hand, she's trying to protect herself from her husband. The policeman sees the knife thinking he's under assault. He does what he is permitted to do by law, which is to shoot first and ask questions later. That was a wrenching episode in this city. We went through Mayor Ryan. My predecessor appointed a huge commission that spent about a year looking at this event and others, and we really came up with some recommendations for change for the better. But less than 20 years later, we had police officers on trial in this city who were charged with civil rights violations against blacks who were in that custody. I became mayor. We had other cases, and it continues, and it continues. I think the sadness is this, that it is a fact that we see these episodes occurring over and over again. And it is a fact that disproportionately the number of victims happen to be black and black males. But it's also a fact that 99.9% of police officers never pull that gun, never kill anybody. And people do get concerned. Why do you continue to elevate these situations? They aren't isolated. They really aren't, even though they, you know, we can count them on the fingers of our hand. And so I think that the question that has disturbed me is, you know, after having dealt with this kind of stuff for 40 years, why are we still dealing with it? Why don't we have better understanding? Why haven't we come to better resolution of these problems? And why can't we get an understanding that policemen do make mistakes like any other human being? And yet policemen are made a calling to make snap decisions. I mean, the thing about this and when you see it is they don't get a chance to sit around and say, what's my options? The law says if a police officer sees a threat and he or she believes they are under threat or someone else's lives is under threat, they are authorized by law to use force, whatever force is necessary to subdue that situation. And I'm hopeful that as we go forward from this point on with all of that we've seen in the last 6 or 8 months or a year when you go back, that we will now have a better opportunity to come to some real meaningful consensus on this, because all lives matter. But it is a fact. You don't see many instances where white males are being gunned down by police officers, and that's just a fact of life.
844-295-TALK to join the conversation. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Bill Clark, what do you think?
I agree 100%, and what I'd like to add to that is in many cases, when you see this violence, it is toward the African-American
disproportionately,
community, disproportionately.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that we have is that when you look at the grand juries, their lack of indictments, when you look at the prosecutors, I mean, there really is a problem. And one of the things that I wanted to touch base on was the fact that when you don't get the indictments, and when there's clear cases of police abuse, it does create a situation as though black lives do not matter. And the message that we're trying to say is all lives matter, including the black lives.
Let me go ahead and read what is, in my best estimation, a good crystallization of the other side on this. And that comes from, it often comes from the conservative community. I don't want to make this purely right and left, but that's sort of what has kind of emerged in the last year. And so one of the consistent voices criticizing the Black Lives Matter movement is former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. I want to read some of his recent statements on NBC's Meet the Press and on a Fox News Sunday morning panel, and then we'll get Bill and Bill's comments here. Here's Rudy Giuliani's comments. Quote, "I find it very disappointing that you're not discussing the fact that 93% of blacks in America are killed by other blacks. White police are only in black neighborhoods because of crime. White police officers won't be there if you weren't killing each other 70% of the time. The danger to a black child in America is not a white police officer. That's going to happen less than 1% of the time. The danger to a black child is another black." He later added, "The reason we reduced homicide by 65% in New York City is because we reduced it in the black community, because there is virtually no homicide in the white community." Bill Johnson?
Oh, well, I serve with Rudy Giuliani, and that is the most absurd thing. And I heard him utter those statements because, in fact, this is another fact. 80 or 90% of white people are killed by white people. 80 or 90% of Hispanic people. People are generally killed by people that they know or in close contact with. So he takes that one fact and he really takes it out of context. But also, Mayor Giuliani had Diallo. There were many cases of police overreaction and police abuse during his watch, and he had to contend with it and find a way to deal with it, just like I had to find a way to deal with it. Listen, you know, there were maybe 18 to 24 people during my 12 years who were killed by police officers, okay? And in many instances, I had to rethink my own position. And I came to better understand the conditions under which police officers work. Police officers do dangerous work. It would be the same as saying that 90% of the people of firemen who suffer any kind of injuries during their career experience them while fighting fires. That is their job. It is police officers' jobs to deal with difficult situations. And we have to recognize it. And it's very difficult. When I talk to young African-American men, including my own grandsons, and talk about the way you confront a police officer, even when you think you're right, they are given superpowers to deal with the situation because we send them into very, very difficult situations. But what the Mayor Giuliani does not want to acknowledge is that there is a problem here that has got to be addressed. Listen, Eric Garner, his whole episode was captured on videotape. This is something extraordinarily rare, to see a man being killed before your eyes. And the district attorney of Staten Island, okay, went through a process that led to no indictment of the police officer. Now look what's happening right now in Brooklyn. The officer who shot and killed, and I'm sorry that I can't call the young man's name, who was in the stairwell, and who shot ricocheted off the wall, has just been indicted by a grand jury, okay? The district attorney in that case is African American. You have people now saying, and the police officer's attorney is saying, ah, look, we know that was going to happen. There's a black man here trying to, well, the man in Staten Island, the district attorney, is a hero among conservatives, and he's now running for Congress based on his notoriety in that case.
And the Eric Garner non-indictment.
That's right. Yes. All right. So the question is, on the one hand, the same people who are willing to say that there was no racial prejudice in the case of this non-indictment, because they say, oh, race is not an issue here. White police officer, white district attorney, black victim. All right? All of a sudden want to get on their high horses and inject race and saying, oh, that district attorney cannot be objective. He's a black man, black victim, white police, and it was an Asian police officer. So the point I'm looking, this is the sickening part. You take a set of facts. The facts are this. Does a police officer exceed the authority that he has? Are there other options? In this case, in Brooklyn, they said very clearly, this officer violated his training because he's trained not to have his finger on the trigger. And in fact, because of cases like Diallo and others in New York City, and I read this recently, the department increased the amount of pressure that is required to pull the trigger. In other words, they've gone through tremendous changes to prevent such accidents from happening. And so now the officer, he's not going to jail yet. He has to go to court. He has to go before a jury, and he has to make his case that it was an accident. And he will be subjected to cross-examination, something that did not occur in Ferguson, that did not occur in Staten Island, that the officer goes before a jury where he can be cross-examined and witnesses can be brought to either substantiate or repudiate him. So this is where we are. This is where we are. And it's very disturbing that we have to really try to differentiate between these cases. They are the same set of facts.
Yeah. And a couple of points here. I'm going to let Bill Clark jump in. We're going to get to the phones in just a second. A lot to digest. I think what Bill Johnson is saying is a very important distinction. He's not saying the officer in the Eric Garner case should be convicted. He's saying we should have a chance to take this to a trial and for him to state his case. And we've been deprived of that chance with no indictment.
Absolutely.
So an indictment is not a conviction. But with no indictment, we get no chance to examine it in the form of a trial, which is often the case. Now, let me also say, Bill said that conservatives have made that district attorney in Staten Island a hero. In some circles, yes. I have heard even Bill O'Reilly and some others condemning the Eric Garner case much more vociferously than, say, Tamir Rice or Michael Brown. But I take that point. One other quick question for Bill as a follow-up. Rudy Giuliani, I think you're right to point out that, yes, a black victim of homicide is likely to have been killed by a black person. A white victim of homicide is likely to have been killed by a white person. But the last comment that Mr. Giuliani made was, there is virtually no homicide in the white community. So he may sit here and say, okay, Bill, but whites aren't killing whites.
Well, there's a big movie running now that's probably going to get an Academy Award of a white man killing another white man. This happens more frequently. There are all kinds of cases where parents commit fratricide, kill their children, they kill their spouses. They don't tend to get the kind of notoriety. Maybe in their local communities they get the notoriety. But for Giuliani to say there is no homicide in the white community, that is just way beneath his intelligence to say that. And this, we're talking about a man who was a prosecutor. He knows better.
All right, Bill Clark, go ahead.
I was going to add to that, both in Ferguson and in Staten Island, you had district attorneys that basically rely too heavily on the police department. And because of their friendships and their relationships with the police departments, they did not bring forth indictments. And they were basically acting as defense attorneys for the police officers. And what we're saying is that, you know, should be equal treatment under the law, and there should be, because the role of the police officer is to protect and to serve, not to protect and serve some of the people, but all of the people. And as Mayor Johnson said, there's a small fragment of the police force that is that's not following the rules. But when rules are breaking and when these type of incidents happen, what these families are asking for is for fair treatment under the law, that the DA represent them when they go toward the grand jury to bring back that indictment so that the case could be heard.
And let me add this very quickly. I think that there is a dawning awareness that this is a problem. The New York State Attorney General is now recommending changes in the grand jury system. It remains to be seen whether New York State Legislature will deal with that, but hopefully it'll get an airing. The director of the FBI gave a speech, yes, very well received last week, in which he pointed out that there is bias in policing, and it needs to be addressed and it needs to be responded to. Now, the irony is Eric Holder, the Attorney General, can make the same statement, and he's condemned for being a race man by saying something that is so blatantly racist or racial. And then when the director of the FBI, a white man, comes along, everybody says, oh, this ought to be something we ought to give into consideration. See, we really need to understand that there's not only a problem here, but there has been a kind of a defensiveness about it. Listen, you know, I spent 12 years as mayor. I became very, very close to the work of the police department. We made many substantial reforms in the way policing was done here in Rochester. And we did it with the support and cooperation of the police themselves. We introduced community-oriented policing, and despite the objection of that leadership, the president of the Locust Club, who said this was social work, I just read a letter. I was going through my files the other day. I found a letter I sent to County Executive Jack Doyle. He made that same statement. He attacked a panel that we put together. I had forgotten this until I read the letter dealing with violence. And he said this is nothing but social work. So you've got people who have taken that position. But listen, police officers themselves, they don't want to be targets, and they don't want to be derided for the work that they do. I mean, I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of the policemen and policewomen that I've met in this city were serious about their work. They were serious about relating to
Absolutely.
The communities that they do. They mm-hmm. were not pulling their guns. You know, they were not pulling their guns and shooting people indiscriminately. And I think we have to say that. We have to say that. This is not something that happens every day of the week. It happens more than it should happen, but it does not happen as frequently as some people want to make it. But we cannot say that they operate under a perfect system. There are flaws and there are needs for reforms, and I think we need to move in that direction.
The part that was always strange to me was this notion that any discussion over these incidents is tantamount to attacking police officers. In my company, in WXXI, if there's somebody who is not pulling their weight, or if they're mm-hmm. shirking their duty, or if they're embarrassing our company, I want them out. And I don't view it as an attack on WXXI, and just so happens we have a perfect organization. But if we did, you would want them out. That's not an attack on my organization. That's actually supporting my organization to point out what's wrong. I think the debate is, you know, how widespread is it? How do you fix it, et cetera? Let's get to the phones, and I want to remind you why Bill and Bill are here. Bill Johnson and Bill Clark are here, the former CEO and the current CEO of the Urban League of Rochester. They're celebrating 50 years, so much as you can celebrate an organization that was really born out of need, 1965, post-riots. We'll get to that coming up here. And if you don't know exactly what the Urban League of Rochester does, and many of us don't have a perfect understanding, we're going to talk about that as well. They've got an event coming up, a luncheon and fundraiser that's going to happen at noon on Tuesday, March 10th. Tuesday, March 10th at the Rochester Riverside Radisson Hotel. That is downtown, of course. And so noon, Tuesday, March 10th. And Bill Clark, if people want to go, how do they go?
Yes, contact the Urban League of Rochester, 325-6530, and we will make the arrangements to have individuals there.
All right, 844-295-TALK. Let's get to the phones, and this is Greg and Henrietta. Go ahead, Greg.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my phone call. I just have a couple quick comments to Mr. Johnson and Mr. Clark, and then I'll hang up and see what they have to say. in my opinion, until the Fed requires the state and each municipal police department to track the actual data, and let me give you an example. The race of the officer, the race of the alleged criminal, and the weapon used. And I don't doubt what's going on is going on, Mr. Johnson. I agree wholly with you. But here's been my experience. I've been trying to get information from 2006 to date for any occurrence of violence between a police officer and an alleged criminal, including up to and including death. I've contacted Mike Green. I've contacted the city of Rochester, the county of Monroe, as well as Sandra Dorley. Can't get the information. It is not listed, the race, the weapon used, and the crime up to, unfortunately, Officer Daryl Person. And I was wondering if you might have some insight into that. Thank you.
Greg, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, the collection of this data is not thorough, and it's been reported. I read a big account, I think it was in USA Today about a week ago, that said that a lot of departments weren't reporting officer-related shootings. So the kind of data that you and I could agree should be just sort of automatically collected needs to be standardized, and it needs to be required as part of the uniform reporting system. I think that departments themselves can exercise better control and, in fact, require that when an officer has to use his gun, his or her gun, that there is some very, very comprehensive reporting of that. Who was the, you know, what was the circumstance? Who was the suspect or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many shots were fired? You know, back in around 2003, 2004, I don't know if people will remember, we had a horrific month in August of 2002,
yeah,
where there were four black men who died at the hands of the Rochester Police Department. That was very, very trying for us. And earlier in that same year, we had a young 14-year-old boy who was killed by police officers. So it was a tough year for all of us. And we hired Cedric Alexander, who is now the head of police in Decatur, Georgia. Cedric Alexander came as a deputy police chief, and he's a psychologist by training. And that's one of the reasons I wanted him on the department. And we went through a couple of very significant protocols. One thing we did was he created something called the Emotionally Disturbed Persons Team, which says that when a police officer was engaged with a person, and if there was time, there would be specially trained police officers dispatched to that scene. We were to do everything that we could to defuse that situation without using deadly force. And so we had a number of officers who went through that training who were on call at every shift. They had people who could be dispatched. The second thing that he did was, you know, tasers were coming into use then. And if you watch these cop shows on television, you'll see people use tasers just like they chew mm-hmm. gum. They use them, you know, as an offensive as well as a defensive weapon. Well, under Deputy Chief Alexander, they created a protocol that says, because the gun has a little dial on it, a register. So every time the taser was used, okay, the officer had to file a report. What was the circumstances? Why did you use the taser? What were your options? They had plenty of time after that.
Who'd you use it on?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They had plenty of time.
Yeah.
But then what we found is that the officer was less likely to go pull out that taser, knowing all of the paperwork that mm-hmm. they had to fill out in order to justify. Because if you couldn't justify why you used that taser, you had baton, you had mace, you had other things short, because tasers, and here's the other thing they did. No police officer could use the taser until they had themselves been tased. They wanted the officer to know what it felt like to get hit with, say, 1,500, 2,000 volts of electricity through your body. So I know that there are training protocols which police departments can use to minimize and mitigate a lot of this stuff that people end up getting upset about. The thing about chokeholds, you know,
yes,
it's very, very important. What does a chokehold do? Every time you struggle to get out of a chokehold, you essentially are applying pressure on your vocal cords. You're killing yourself. So people should not use that tactic as except as a last resort. And this is conscious training and planning that you put your department through. I don't care if you got two officers or you got 2,000, you should actually spend a lot of time on training to avoid these kinds of deadly situations that we have to spend a lot of time trying to deal with.
All right, a couple points there. To following up on Greg's point, do we need to do a better job of tracking statistics?
Absolutely.
Yes. And the other thing that needs to be tracked is the alleged crime of the victim, and also the alleged crime of the suspect, and the outcome of that crime, especially if the individual ends up dead. I mean, what did the suspect allegedly do? I mean, when you look at Ferguson, when you look at New York City, does selling loose cigarettes deserve a death penalty?
That's right. And the police would tell you they didn't try to kill Eric Garner, but he was resisting arrest. And look, I think of Bill Johnson's point about the tasers, which is interesting, that once officers knew that the use of a taser was going to be much more closely monitored, their use of it dropped. That is similar to what we have seen when it comes to body cameras with police, mm-hmm. that when mm-hmm. there are cameras, police are less likely to use force and deadly force. We know that. That's been tracked. But let me start with Bill Johnson. Two sides to that argument. Some people say, good, police officers should know that if you're being watched, if you're going to use force or deadly force, use it when it's absolutely appropriate, but don't abuse it. Others say, if you are paralyzing officers with fear, this notion that if I have to pull a gun or if I've got to use force, I'm going to be overly scrutinized, you're putting them at risk to overthink a situation. Where do you come down?
Well, but if you can justify, in other words, I think the point Bill just made is an excellent point. And, of course, it does require the officer to do a lot of quick thinking, okay? But in a situation like Eric Garner, even in the situation like Michael Brown, these events unfolded over a period of time. It wasn't an instantaneous. See, and even with Tamar Rice, the fact that there was a video that showed that the officers pulled up and instantaneously pulled out his
That's
gun
right.
and started
That's
shooting.
Right.
All right, he didn't even ascertain whether there was a threat. All right, and so policemen are just like any other profession, physicians, dentists, you know, they ask you if you get in a dental chair for a procedure, are you allergic to anesthesia? And if you say yes, they're not going to put you under anesthesia. So policemen need to also ask these very, very simple questions. And I think that what we're seeing now is that there is a sensitivity. I saw on CNN or somewhere the other day, there's so many of these things happening there, I can't keep them all sorted out of my mind. But there's a situation that happened just recently where there were a bunch of officers attacking someone, stomping him, kicking him on the ground, and the car cam was running. And you actually hear somebody say, do you realize that this is now being filmed? And they go shut the camera off, all right? So now, why would they shut the camera off? I mean, is that probable cause to suspect that they were doing something that they know they could not substantiate? So they go shut. So now this whole incident is being investigated. And the fact is that now, where before it was just merely my word against the police officers, there was no corroboration.
So body cameras, absolutely yes. And
yes,
mind.
Absolutely.
Yes.
If, if you're not doing anything wrong, why would you object to having the camera running?
Yes, even through our national office, we're putting together a national campaign asking that all police forces do wear the body cameras.
Okay, I'm going to get to the phones, and in fact, the host only has two questions left in the hour, and my goal is to let the phones do the rest of it. And before I get there, so if you're waiting on the phone, we will come to you as we're talking to Bill Clark and Bill Johnson, the current CEO and former CEO of the Urban League of Rochester, which is marking 50 years. Bill Johnson just mentioned Michael Brown, Tamir Rice. Now, we talked about Rudy Giuliani's criticism of all of this. Interesting point from someone very different than Rudy Giuliani, and that's Nicholas Kristof. Nick Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times and hardly in the same political camp as Rudy Giuliani. Mm-hmm. But Nick Kristof last month was reading about the Tamir Rice case. And if you don't know the Tamir Rice case, the short encapsulation is it was around Thanksgiving in Cleveland. Police got report of a person in a park who looked like he was menacing, waving a gun. Now, the sad thing is the person who called into the park said, number one, I think it's a kid, and number two, I don't think the gun is real. Turned out it was a 12-year-old kid, and it was a fake gun. The dispatcher didn't relay all of that to police, which was a big mistake to begin with. But the officer, they roll up on the scene. They see the kid near the gazebo. He gets shot before the officer even gets out of the car. The officer shoots from the car in, I think, less than 10 seconds.
2 seconds.
2 seconds. So the kid is dead. They even prevent his sister from trying to help. They tackle his sister to the ground. The kid bleeds out and dies. And I think it was an off-duty FBI agent who came and tried to eventually apply CPR. It turns out the officer who fired the shot was dismissed from Independence, that's a suburb of Cleveland, for poor behavior. He was deemed unfit in terms of firearms training. Cleveland police hire him anyway. It is a mess. It is clearly a mess. Nick Kristoff writes this on Twitter. Quote, activists perhaps should have focused less on Michael Brown, more on shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland. And boy, did Nick Kristoff get a backlash. People were saying, these all matter the same. And Nick Kristoff is saying, if you want to stake one to your cause, pick Eric Garner or Tamir Rice. To Nick Kristoff, he looks at the Michael Brown case and says, you know, the facts don't necessarily support that it was hands up, don't shoot. Unfortunately, the facts are indicate that if you look at the autopsy and everything else, maybe he did reach into the car and try to grab an officer's gun. And maybe if you do that, you could get killed. Whereas Tamir Rice and Eric Garner, it's mind-boggling that those people are dead. Bill Johnson, do you agree with Nick Kristoff that activists should focus more on that? Or do you think focus on all of them?
Well, I think you have to focus on all of them because each of them bring a different set of circumstances. The Tamir Rice case, we haven't even begun to hear all of that. That matter hasn't been taken, or if it's before grand jury, there's been no resolution of that.
If there's no indictment there, by the way, it's going to be.
And you have to indict the entire city government, because how did this guy get hired in the first place? I mean, they did a very, very poor job of vetting this man before they decided to hire him and put him in the inner city. I mean, you have him patrol parking lot somewhere out in the suburbs, but do not give him a gun and send him. But let me just go back to this point, because I think this is important. Think about Michael Brown. When Michael Brown first was killed, there was tremendous outrage universally, because it was described as an unarmed young black man who was walking away from the police, who was not threatening to the police. And then other details began to slip out. Oh, he was caught on video robbing a corner store. He was walking down the middle of the street. What happens here, Evan, is that there's a tendency among all of us to try to figure out a way to rationalize things that aren't easily reconciled. So now, all of a sudden, it's easier to side with the police officer if you begin to think that Michael Brown was a bad guy, We don't know that, because it goes to the very point that Bill made. The fact is that the district attorney for St. Louis County acted as that police officer's defense counsel.
Yes.
All right. And he can say all he wants that he brought all of these various people. I thought it was amazing. He said, I knew that I was putting people on the stand who were going to give perjured testimony, who were going to give false testimony. Why would you do that? Unless you were trying to muddy the waters. And so that he would not have been able to get away with that if it had been a trial. All people are saying is, bring the officer to trial. And if his version of the facts are sustained, he will not be convicted. He will be found innocent. And every civilian, I don't know many civilians that can tell a story, you know, unless you're George Zimmerman. I don't know many of them that can tell a story and escape. But even George Zimmerman had to hire a pack of lawyers very skillfully, and he had to put on a defense. He didn't just tell his story and walk away. What people are saying now is police officers should not be given carte blanche to just say what they want to say, do what they want to do, and know that there's nobody going to hold them accountable. That's the issue that we're talking about.
All right, quick word, Bill Clark.
I would say in the Michael Brown case, when the incident happened, the only thing he was guilty of was walking in the street. The other information had not been relayed. The officer had no indication that he had taken cigars out of a store. So basically, does jaywalking require a death sentence? I think that case should have been handled differently, and I think that is just as important as as the Tamir case.
All right. We're going to take a 60-second break, and your phone calls are next. We're talking to Bill Clark and Bill Johnson about 50 years of the Urban League of Rochester. They mark 50 years with a luncheon and fundraiser. That is coming up on Tuesday, the 10th of March. I had the date right. That's right. Tuesday, March 10th at noon at the Rochester Riverside Radisson Hotel. That's in downtown Rochester. And if you want tickets, you can call the Urban League, 325-6530, 325-6530, or visit them online, ulr.org. Your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli sits down with us in studio. We'll talk to him about the process that led to the selection of not Joe Morelli, but Carl Hastie from the Bronx as new speaker. Is that the end of the chances for an upstate Democrat to lead the assembly? What about ethics reform? Should lawmakers disclose outside income? And what about other state business? Join us. The conversation starts next hour with Joe Morelli.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Connections. We're just talking during our brief break about how it is pretty remarkable that there are some folks who feel like police officers would never do anything wrong, and there are some folks who feel that police officers would never do anything right and no police officer is trustable. And both views are essentially toxic to me. I don't think it's mutually exclusive to look at police and say, I'm amazed at the work that you can do, and I am so thankful that you do it, and I respect you, and I'm going to raise my child to salute you and shake your hand if he sees you in the street. At the same time, you are an officer of the government who happens to be armed, and we are going to have very high standards for your conduct. And in the rare cases, but important cases where you make mistakes, you're going to be held accountable. Those shouldn't be mutually exclusive, right?
That's right.
You know, it seems to be that we can't hit both, and I don't think that's healthy. So let's see what our listeners want to say, and I'm going to start with John in Brighton. Go ahead, John.
Hi, thank you. I agree that there's a serious problem here. To solve it, we need to be able to discuss it. And to discuss it, we need to be much more precise with our use of language and statistics. We repeatedly hear this statistic of a disproportionate number of young black males are shot by policemen. But there's a reason for that when we look deeper into the statistics. That doesn't prove the point by any means, and in fact, it's a little misleading the way it's being used. There's a lot of insinuation and more, actually, outright accusation of prejudice and misbehavior in front of the grand jury in the Ferguson case, Michael Brown in particular. But we don't really know what went on in that grand jury. This is, we bring a certain bias to our view. And finally, this whole idea that all we want to do is just indict them and put a man on trial for murder, even when the grand jury in a legitimate process might find that there is not sufficient evidence to try it. That's not a solution to just try everybody so that there's some kind of clarity. We have a two-stage process here, and it's there for a good reason, and it goes back to the founding of the nation. This isn't something that has been invented for nefarious purposes.
One quick point, and I'll let Bill and Bill respond to that as well. The old saw in legal circles in this country is that you can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. That's the old saw, that it is not difficult to get a grand jury to indict, and look, that's a cliche, but some people are looking at the Eric Garner case, for example, and saying, you know, that's not a ham sandwich. That's a man who died while he was saying, I can't breathe. He was selling Lucy's on the sidewalk. He was not threatening people. Now, he was resisting their attempt to arrest him on an afternoon, and he's a big guy, but they put him in a hold that, by many accounts, they should never have used. And if you can't indict that, that's why some people in the black community say, we are not looking at an equal circumstance. What do you think?
Briefly, could I just say,
sure,
every case is different. And there's
absolutely
certainly many. I'm not trying to say that one way or the other on any of them. I'm just saying we need to get precise and careful and non-inflammatory with our language and our use of statistics. We don't know that the DA in Ferguson was a racist who just refused to indict a ham sandwich. We don't know that. Let's not say it as if it's a fact and then repeatedly say it's a fact. We know, yes, of course, more young black men get shot than young white men in proportion to their numbers in society. But there's a reason for that. More young black men are in the context where there's a violent situation happening disproportionately. We got to go past that to a more serious and less polemic discussion of this if we want to make any progress. Otherwise, we just drive people into these extremes that you've discussed.
John, thank you for the call. In other words, I think he's saying we can't be apologists for the fact that there are real problems within urban centers, black communities that need to be addressed too. Bill Clark?
But what Mike doesn't understand is we do know that every witness in the Michael Brown case that went before the grand jury indicated they felt like they were being cross-examined, that they were treated hostile. And we do know that the district attorney was asked to recluse himself of the case prior to any proceedings because of his past experience. I think his father was the victim of a homicide, and it was felt that he could not be objective in this case. And, these facts we do know, and we see these facts time and time again in these cases. So you have to draw the logical conclusion that it's not a fair process.
Okay. Bill Johnson?
Well, and I'll just add an additional fact. There is at least one member of that grand jury who has petitioned the court to be allowed to talk about what happened in the grand jury process, who is very much concerned. So, and I think the district attorney is fighting that to suppress that because he says that's not permitted under law. So there are things going on. We remember the juror in the I'm getting old now. George Zimmerman case.
Yes.
Okay.
Trayvon Martin, George
Trayvon,
Zimmerman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who came out after the fact and she revealed herself and said she felt she was under tremendous pressure. She was holding out for a mistrial and she was under tremendous pressure to convict. So, yes, I think John is absolutely right. And he would be surprised that I would agree with most of what he's saying because it is not a good, healthy thing that we're having people choose sides here and refusing to look beyond, what is in their comfort zone. There are serious issues that we really need to be honestly able to discuss if we're going to make some progress. But policing is changed. I just got sent something yesterday that was on NPR, and you might be familiar with it, Evan. There was a case of three young white men in Mississippi who were convicted of murdering a black man. These weren't police officers. These were three civilians. And the judge in the case was a black federal judge. And he delivered this powerful speech to them. And he went through the history of race relations in Mississippi. And what he said was that, he was now being told this is just an aberration. These are fine young men, and they shouldn't go to jail. Blah 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 blah. And he said, I want to tell you, things you did in that. Now I read that, and I was startled and by really the strength of this message. But I know that there are people in Mississippi who probably got this man on a to die list for being so brazen and so bold as to talk about the history of that wonderful state. We need conversations about race in this country. People just tense up when you want to talk about everything is fine, they say. Why do we want to talk about race? That was my grandfather's generation. We got a black president. Why do you want to talk about race? Because we still have racial problems. And each case is different. Each case is different.
And I think that's part of what John's saying. And a couple quick little follow-ups there. I spoke to a longtime English teacher yesterday who teaches at a wealthy suburban district here. And she said she has to argue with her students that racism still exists. It is a mostly white district. And she said she literally has students saying, come on. And she has to tell them, whoa, get outside your experience here. That was pretty shocking for me to hear, but probably it shouldn't be. But Bill, back to
the headliner. Here's Evan. There are a lot of young black kids who were born in the 80s and 90s, you know, like my grandkids. They don't understand. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? You know, this is history. This is ancient history. No, it's now. And I'm not saying things have improved. I can leave this earth. If I were to die next minute, I would say I'm leaving a world that is much better and far more progressive than the world that I was born into and that the world that I started working in. But to say that the work is done, that there are no racial problems anymore.
But I think the people like John and Brighton would say, but Bill, remember when Letitia Parson died and you stood up and you said you were pissed off?
Yeah.
Those were your words. Yeah. And you were tired of lack of accountability, and you wanted to see, in particular, more black males step up, be fathers, be accountable. And John's saying, don't forget that. Let's look inward as well in our community and say, if there are more black youths in violent situations, why and how do we fix that?
And we don't. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing about celebrating the Urban League is looking at its history. Right today, you know, agencies like the Urban League are working with young black men, telling them to live up to your responsibilities, not patting them on the head and exonerating them and say, you got to be better fathers, you got to get skills, you got to stay in school. And, you know, that doesn't get the same kind of headlines.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. Bill Clark, for people who don't really know the Urban League's mission, it's been 50 years, founded in 1965 at a particularly fraught time for Rochester. Here in 2015, what is the mission of the Urban League?
And the beauty of this is the mission of the Urban League hasn't changed since 1910 when the national office was incorporated. And it's a mission of equality, social and economic equality. We work with young folks to make sure that the educational outcomes they receive are not disparate, that they're at the same level as their counterparts. We also work with families. We work with maintaining families and making sure that the family unit stays together, working with the parents, working with the children, working with the whatever resources we need. We operate an entrepreneurial development center where we work with young entrepreneurs. We've developed numerous businesses throughout the Rochester community because we know that economic self-sufficiency is a pillar of the Urban League. Our housing programs, we've built well over 300 houses for individuals, both new homes and complete HUD rehabs within the city of Rochester. So the Urban League, we also work with the developmentally disabled, and we provide a wide array of services. We're currently operating over 25 different programs, touching the lives of over 15,000 Rochesterians per year.
All right, I'm going to ask you a very unfair question because I've got about 90 seconds left here, but I wanted to get more into poverty, concentration of poverty, housing, jobs. That's another day, unfortunately. You've seen what's happened this hour. But when it comes to concentration of poverty, Ed Doherty, who helped author recent reports on poverty, says that Rochester's concentration of poverty is essentially a choice of policy that has to be reversed, and it is worse than other cities of its size in this country. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. And the other thing that we say is, the city of Rochester cannot solve the poverty problem by itself because poverty is so concentrated in the city. We need to get the surrounding suburbs. We need to get the entire Monroe County region to, when they're putting together their consolidated plans for HUD, so that they develop housing. They develop
they have to be willing.
Income. Yes, and that's, unfortunately, that's a barrier that we're still working at because it's a great problem, and it's a problem that Rochester cannot solve by itself.
30 seconds. Bill Johnson, concentration of poverty. You were the mayor. How do you fix that? I mean, tell me in 30 seconds.
Well, you know, I just saw a story in this morning's paper about this poverty task force, and I said, you know, it's a very simple but very complicated solution. The best poverty solution is a job, that everybody has a job. And yet we live in a new economy which has marginalized a lot of people so that there aren't jobs that fit their skill sets, and it's very difficult for them to get the skills for the jobs that are available. So I think until we attack that problem, we're going to, unfortunately, your predecessor and Bill's predecessor, 50 years from now, going to be talking about the same thing. We got to give people opportunities to take care of themselves, and that's a job.
Bill Johnson was CEO of the Urban League for 21 years, 1 month. Bill Clark has been the CEO for 21 years, 1 month. And the two longest-serving CEOs of the Urban League of Rochester sharing their thoughts on 50 years of the Urban League of Rochester. You can attend their 50-year luncheon and fundraiser, noon, Tuesday, March 10th, at the Rochester Riverside Radisson Hotel. Check out ulr.org for tickets or call 325-6530. Joe Morelli, next hour on Connections.